Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listed on the menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
It's that time of the week again.
It is that time of the week, and I wish it would get to be that time of the year when we see some real warm weather. I mean, everything's sprouting in the garden.
Ah, but we're ahead of the game, and this week's program reflects that because what are we doing? We're California dreaming.
California bound.
So we assembled a few interviews in this week's program to give you a taste of California, a taste that we'll be enjoying of both food and wine while we're out there next month. We know that you'll
this month. Aren't we?
No. You're getting your months mixed up. We'll be in California in May. Last time I checked, it's still April. So we're starting out with a fascinating chef. A chef with a fascinating history, because he's from the Basque region of France, close to the Spanish border, but found his way to California, to San Francisco, apparently with a lot of his fellow countrymen, as he told us, He has two excellent restaurants. We actually came across him in a restaurant earlier than that.
Yeah, that's in the discussion.
Years and years ago. You find it all in there. And he's talking about the fact that he just published a cookbook all about the style of cooking that he's doing. He calls it California Basque. And guess what? We're going to be enjoying it for ourselves in person in just a few weeks' time. So we'll be collecting some more thoughts from Chef Gerald.
You always call him Gerard. I never can get it right.
Anyway, he is Gerald
Irigoyen.
Irigoyen. There you go. We managed to get that one out too.
Now, Gerald Irigoyen goes back with us quite a long time. I was trying to figure out how many years it was, Gerald. We first encountered you at the restaurant, which was in an area called eventually called Soma, which Fringale was the restaurant, which was not built up at all, and then now it's a whole different case. And then we encountered you much later then at your restaurant, Piperade, in San Francisco.
That's right.
And now you have another restaurant. You are no longer attached to the Fringale. You have two restaurants of your own, and they are...
I have Piperade, of course, and then Bocadillos, which is our newest little tapas bar in San Francisco.
Uh-huh. Now, the book we're going to be talking about today is called Pintos?
The way we say it's Pinchos.
Pinchos. I knew I was doing it wrong. Pinchos.
That's what we call Pinchos. That's what we call tapas in the Basque region. We call them Pinchos.
Yeah, now I wanted to ask you about the Basque. I mean, we love Basque cooking.
Right.
Is there any kind of basic difference between you're from the French side and
yes.
We've always experienced the Spanish side? What is the main difference there?
Well, the main difference, to be honest with you, I think the Basque cuisine on the French side sort of got lost, and because not only probably because of the strong culinary France has to provide, and also it's a very small territory. So I think on the Spanish side, the Basque stay through their cuisine because it's a lot bigger. There's a lot more people, so I think they stay through to their roots. So I think at one time the Spanish Basque were looking to the French for the techniques and a lot of ideas, but I think they stay through to their roots, and so I think they sort of came back, even though they never left, but they sort of really embraced the French techniques. They came back and sort of elevated their cuisine.
Well, who do you, Gerald, do you identify more with the Basque culture or the French culture?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, you're born French, but definitely with the Basque culture. You know, when you're born a Basque man, you have to choose either you're going to be a Spanish or Frenchman, but you know, you really deep in your heart, you know, Basque is your country in some ways, if I put it this way. So, and same thing as a chef. I mean, I've been here for many, many years. There's a very strong culture of Basque cuisine in California because a lot of Basque people immigrated in this country in the late 19th centuries as a sheep herder. They started and then they sort of established themselves at hoteliers and places like that. So it was really important for me coming from the Basque region to come here and to sort of, we used to have a lot more Basque restaurants. They sort of disappeared over the years. And for me, it was really important to sort of carry on the tradition here.
Now, how did you actually get here?
How did I?
Yes, I mean, did you come with family or?
No, I just came by myself. You know, growing up as a kid in the Basque region, you always see the stories on the newspaper of the Basque immigrating to the California, especially California and the United States.
And Utah, I found that was odd.
Yeah, Utah, all the western states, there's a very strong Basque population all over up and down the coast here. So, you know, for me, I was kind of fascinated and by this also, and I was, you know, I knew my job, I knew my trade, and I said, you know what, I wanted to try to give it a shot. Not knowing was I was really getting into it. So, but you know, I came here and finding this great community of Basque people here really, you know, helped me with my trade to do what I do now.
Now, Basques are really viewed in Spain as the best chefs, cooks.
Yeah,
in Spain.
Although that's a relatively new phenomenon.
Well, exactly. I mean, that sort of have.
It's not a new phenomenon.
In the old days, we always considered Basque chefs. When you were in Spain and you were going to a restaurant, even if you were in Madrid or somewhere else, you say, there's a Basque chef in the house. You know you were getting into, supposedly, a very good restaurant. So they always had that great reputation.
Yeah, they had those cooking societies.
Yes.
All men.
Exactly. In Spain, where you're supposed to have all the best chefs, were supposed to be from the Basque region, which now, of course, with the extension of the Spanish cuisine in general, it might not be true at all, even though the Basque region probably remained one of the biggest concentration of three stars rest Spain.
Yes. Now, could you explain what do you feel is the essence of Basque cuisine?
Well, the essence to me, first of all, we got to go with the product, because if you go back into the Basque region, you live in a region where you have a fantastic product. You have the ocean. We have the mountains. We have a beautiful lamb and sheep, and everybody loves to cook. There is a certain engagement by the population of, like, excelling of eating from the simple in the house to the gastronomic society, mostly directed by men. And so it's everywhere, you know, you go into the Basque region, it's all about food. So I think when you start with that kind of passion and commitment with the people, I think that brings the best of what you can get in a beautiful region where you can find some of the best product in the world.
Now, you're fortunately in that position in California, which is blessed in a very similar way, I guess.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, being, you know, involved with these strong Basque populations, the openness of the people here in this country and California, I think it's a wonderful place to wonderful foods. And I always keep my Basque heritage in check. That's how I cook. But of course, you know, I moved away, so you sort of have to take that in consideration always in your cooking. And so that's what I try to reflect in my restaurants, even though maybe you would come and you would say it's not necessarily Basque, but if you picked it up and I could explain to you why the reason, even though our cuisine is not really out there, but I think we have a cuisine of the marché or the market, the mercado, depending which language you want to say.
Yeah.
Sure.
Mercatu in Basque. And so that's really what I try to respect and try to excel. And I'm so proud of bringing that sort of attitude and keeping that alive.
Now, the book, tell us a little bit about the organization of the book.
It's
because the title says Pinchos, as if it's all tapas size portions, but it really isn't. It's more about a complete overview of the dishes that you prepare at both of the restaurants, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. I mean, and this is actually really inspired from the tapas bar that we have, Pinchos bar called Bocadillos. And so the menu, it's, the way we lay out the menu is kind of by technique, if you will, or by item. So we break it down. We have a la plancha, then we have the shelling beans. A la plancha, I mean, cooked on the griddle. We have the bocadillos, we have the little sandwich, we have the stew and the braised meats. So that's how we did this little book, and giving about 10 to 8 recipes on each categories. And try to make it very simple in a small little portion, like you were, if you were going to a pincho bar, a tapas bar, you would be able to enjoy and to do. So that really reflects our little restaurant, Bocadillos, which I think when you do a pincho bar, a tapas bar, to me, a tapas bar is not a tapas bar with like 250 people in the place. It has to be sort of tiny, where you can find a good little glass of wines, some small little plates. And unfortunately here, when people come in, they just do a big meal in a tapas bar. If you think about it, if you were going to Spain, you go in a tapas bar and you go from little places to little place. And some places are known for certain specialties. So you can hop around from different place and having, you know, a glass of wine and everything. It's kind of like a little marathon. Like,
you know, what is that marathon called in Basque, the crawl of the tapas places?
Yeah, the chiquiteo.
Chiquiteo.
Yeah.
I tell you a funny thing, Gerald. We were with Juan Maria Azak and his daughter in San Sebastian and a couple of other great chefs there too. But they gave us a list of their favorite pink sauce places in San Sebastian, but they said we mustn't give them to anybody. we could use them ourselves, but we were not allowed to reveal them.
I think they were all sort of secret.
No, I think they were very serious about that.
Yeah.
What are you saying, Gerald?
No, I think they're pretty much out. Not everybody knows them, but I think there's a few standard that you love to go when you go to San Sebastian's, and they're fantastic. And I think Juan Mari and his daughter are the great promoters of the Basque cuisine throughout the years, and they're fantastic people. And actually, I got to walk around San Sebastian with Donostia, as we say in Basque, with Juan Mari, and he's just like, he's like the Pope.
Isn't he amazing?
I'm sure he's like the Pope. He's such a funny fellow. It's the first time in all the interviews that we've done where one of his first questions of me was, how old are you? it turns out that we're the same age. Now, you've seen my picture on our website, and you know Juan Mari. I don't know which of us is wearing better. I know which one of us is more clearly a chef.
Yes, exactly.
Well, now, what are your favorite things to work with? And you like seafood? You like roasted meat?
Well, you know, it's amazing. And it is always, I always have such a tough time answering that question. Because to be honest with you, I'm a chef. I kind of like to do everything, and depends, you know, if I'm into doing seafood, then seafood's going to be my thing for that moment, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
If I do a meat, so it's always difficult. It's getting a raw product turned into something who's fantastic, and that's really the pleasure that I get of cooking.
Well, you know, that you've seen it all in Basque cuisine, but now it's everyone's enthroned. It's the height of the culinary world at this point.
Yes.
What do you think happens next?
Well, I just don't know what's going to happen next. The fact of the matter is we always knew that, you know, Basque cuisine was a great cuisine. And I think with, the power of the media, the internet, and Basque people realizing that they were great chefs, but maybe the whole world didn't know about it yet. I think that's what we're seeing right now. So there's a lot of exposure, and it is indeed a great place to eat and to dine. So I think we're seeing more of that, and with the chef leading now in the Basque region, I think we're gonna we know that in the world the Basque cuisine has its roots and its place, and I think it's gonna be there for the long run. So I don't think the people who are there, maybe they are noticed more than it used to be, but I don't think it's a fad. It's something who's there to stay, and I cannot really speak about the future, but you know, they're always gonna be on the trend and on the verge of doing what's next, and who knows what's going to be next.
Yeah, they're
good cooking always.
They're in the third generation of the new Basque kitchen at this point.
Yeah, there's a whole new generation of young chefs.
Sure. Right.
But, you know, I'm just hoping also they're going to stay and learn about their tradition and try to keep that alive.
I think
the thing about that struck me about this book is it's really well grounded.
Right.
I mean, it's solid. It's use of all ingredients. So on the cover are little cubes of calf's liver and onions on a skewer, and there's a recipe for tripe, and there's a recipe for
pig's
feet.
Because also, I didn't really want to do a chef. I mean, there's a big trend into molecular cuisine, and I think he has its place.
Uh-huh.
And but, you know, it's not, first of all, it's not my style, perhaps, but I also want the people to be able, you know, the joy I have of my cookbooks, and I've done, this is my third one, I got people coming back to me, I say, you know what, I've done this, and it works.
Yeah.
So I try to give a flair of what we can do, but also I want the people to be able to recreate those recipes, because that's what it's all about.
Yeah, how many people have a circulation, heat circulator, immersion circulator, whatever it is.
Right.
Now, there's one recipe you downsized a little bit. And it's worth going over this particular recipe because I don't know that I ever before thought of a whole octopus as a hangover cure. I don't know if you saw that recipe, but Gerald, he talks about the fact that he was in Murcia, was it?
Yeah, in Murcia.
He was in Murcia nursing a hangover with some of his friends. And they went into a restaurant, and the restaurant had a huge cauldron of boiling beer.
Exactly.
And the owner grabbed a whole octopus and threw it in the boiling beer.
And trust me, this is one of the best memories of my life. I was there with a good friend of mine who's a great wine maker and also importer from Spain, Jorge Ordóñez. So we were there, and we saw this big cauldron coming out with this thing, and we asked the guy, "Where is this giant octopus?" So we talked about it, and right there he just cut a few tentacles and sprinkled with just a little bit of sea salt, and that was probably one of the best things I had in my life.
You said it also cured the hangover. Now, I was interested in something there, and it leads me to another aspect of the book, which is very interesting, because when you make your octopus recipe based on this whole experience, mm-hmm. instead of pairing it with beer, which is what you said you had on the famous hangover occasion, you actually pair it with wine.
Yes.
But another thing for listeners and potential readers of the book to understand is that each one of the recipes that you have here has a selection of wine to go along with it.
Yes.
Which is extremely useful. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, to me, wine and food pairing is very important. So many different food can taste great, but if you can enhance with a glass of wine, we're going to be appropriate. I think it's fantastic. So being a great wine lover myself, maybe not the greatest expert, but I do think I can drink wine. I really appreciate it. It was really important to me to create some nice dish and to introduce the people a little bit of the wines of Spain, too. It's kind of like the reflex of what I do in my other restaurants, where we have a wine from only California of grapes, Spanish grapes, but made in California.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, and we have, of course, all the great Spanish wines and all the wine regions of Spain, which I think Spain, even though probably one of the largest producers of wine in the world, just realized how great what they were selling and just start to pay attention and making some more little boutique wines and some fabulous wine. I mean, the wines from Galicia, the wines from Ruedas and places like that are just fantastic. The Cava from Catalonia, of course, the red from the Rioja, Ribera del Duero, and more and more. I mean, they're just
We just went to the wines of Navarra.
Right.
In New York, yeah.
And, so anyway, it's a bounty of things that we have to work with and be inspired from.
I remember that the first wine we had at Piperard the last time we were there was a white Rioja.
Yes.
Which was really excellent, and most people don't even know they make Rioja.
Exactly. They don't make that much, but when they make it good.
Yeah. Now, I had a winemaker on the other day who actually called all the way from Spain because he's coming into a wine festival in our home city, and we wanted to help advertise that festival.
Right.
And he said he makes a white wine in Ribera del Duero, but it's illegal.
It's illegal?
So he makes it, but he can't call it white wine from Ribera del Duero because the designation's all red.
Interesting.
But he makes it anyway.
Now, Gerald, do you speak, is it Euskara?
No, I don't speak the Euskara, unfortunately. It's, I can cook it, but I cannot speak it.
Does that mean you forgot?
No, not really. It was really never passed on to me. And,
I see. So
that's how it goes.
So especially on the French side, probably.
Actually, quite a few of my friends do speak it, maybe on the coast less than used to be in the inside, so that's sort of what it is, and sometimes it's kind of like the tragedy a little bit. And but
what do most people who are Basque, where do they think the language comes from? There's such a debate about it.
Well, you know, to these days, and I'm not quite an expert, but I'm repeating what I've read all over the place. It's like we don't know the origins of the people and the origins of the language. So
right.
So you can quite understand being Basque is something you're going to be really proud of, and that's something that's going to continue more and more. All my little nephews, actually, who are, 10, 12 years old, are going to Basque school where they, where they learn the Basque and to protect and to, making sure the language.
Oh, well, that's a wonderful thing to be happening.
Right.
Well, Pinkstos, I'm sure I...
Pinchos.
Well, I'm English. I butcher everybody else's language. It's just...
It's just a beautiful book.
The way we are.
Listeners, you'll want to get it. It's on our website. Just call it up and click on it and you have it. And it's
stuff you could cook, delicious stuff that you could cook it yourself.
Good.
And thank you so much, Gerald.
You're welcome. Mileshker, as we say in Basque.
Okay.
And hopefully we'll see you soon in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And thank you so much for joining us today with On the Menu.
And keep doing a good job. Thank you.
I can hardly wait. He's just so good. But now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu. Please email us on the menu at onthemenuradio.com or blog us or join our blog at onthemenuradio.blogspot.com.
Or you can Twitter Miss Anne. What's your Twitter name?
OTM Dish.
Yeah, well, I can speak to that. Miss Dishy, well, we do so enjoy hearing from you, but now, of course, we must move on. And if we think of California, we don't only think of fine food in San Francisco, throughout the state for that matter, but we also think of fine wine and interesting wineries. So we have
two
interesting stories back to back. One's very new, very modern, and the other's been in existence.
Organic.
Yeah, and the other one's been in existence for six generations.
That's a nice pair.
So it's quite a pairing. The first one is a winery called Cade. And then the second one is a winery called Mirasu. And in the case of Mirasu, we actually caught up with the owner in Pittsburgh. We're going to catch up with the owners of Cade when we're in California. So first of all, Cade, and then Mirasu.
Well, when we heard that Cade Echo Winery was opening, we just had to get right there and interview the winemaker. And so welcome to On the Menu, Anthony Biaggi.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Tell us about this venture. It is a venture of the Pump Jack Group.
Exactly. Well, you know, our first winery is in Oakville, and we started looking for another project in, gosh, I would like to say 2003, 2004. And we ended up believing in the terroir aspect of growing grapes, which is the site that the grapes grow on is the most important thing. So we looked and looked and looked, and we found a beautiful piece of property, a six-acre piece of property on Howell Mountain. We built this winery from scratch with, of course, as you said, the eco concepts or ecological concepts in mind. So the winery is a green winery. Hopefully it's a LEED certified winery, and hopefully we're going to get gold certification. We don't know yet, but we're striving for that.
That's a whole long process. I mean,
it is. Well, it starts right when you know, it'll be the first winery built from scratch in Napa Valley if we do get the gold certification. That was gold certified.
So you will actually be the first one.
Yes, exactly.
So people are playing around with it, but you've taken the plunge right from the beginning.
Absolutely, and then you know, there are some wineries here that have certain aspects of their winery LEED certified, but you know, or got it after the fact. We actually took the jump right in the planning processes of it to make it all the way to the end.
Now, LEED for listeners who are not familiar. LEED stands for
Leadership in Environmental and Energy Design. If I'm not mistaken, I probably can look into that. But
no, that sounds close enough. And somebody actually administers that program.
There is. It's a government-administered program that you're basically doing everything that's within reason. And our architect worked closely with this group to make sure that everything we were doing, parameters of what we needed.
So. Now, you're a classically trained California winemaker, right?
I am. I went to the University of California at Davis.
And that's where they teach you how to make wines that...
No one can believe that, actually. You know what I mean? But I swear to gosh, yes, I actually went to University of California at Davis, and they have a winemaking program as well as a beer-making program there, if you can believe that.
Right, well,
beers have come along, really.
I don't know. Did you ever run across the book? I forget the name of the lady, but it was all about how she saved the world from Parker.
Oh, yes, I have.
From Parker Station.
And you remember the tasting that somebody tried to trick her, and they served three Chardonnays with lunch and asked her to... tell them what she thought of them, and it turned out that they were all three from the same vineyard, but one hadn't been messed with at all, the second one had been messed with a little bit, and the third one had been messed with a lot, and she picked the one that she thought was the best, which is the one that nobody had messed with. But you talked a little bit about this concept of terroir, and that's, you know, a word that's very popular around the world, or unpopular in some cases, but in the rest of the world, it tends to mean that combination of
dirt and sunshine and all that kind of thing that make a particular plot of wine unique.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
But it's not a word used very commonly in California. California would attract words like overripe, oaky, and high alcohol and things like that.
But they're changing.
They are changing, but...
Changing dramatically,
but
I think.
Tell us what... Give us your definition of California version of terroir.
Well, terroir, for the first and foremost, the hardest thing for Napa Valley to do is we can't be Bordeaux. I use Bordeaux because in the upper Napa Valley, it's mostly Bordelais varietals, so it'd be Cabernet, Merlot, Cabernet Franc, Petit Verdot, and Malbec, of course, being the five. You can use Carmenere in there, too, as a six, but it's not really planted widely in Bordeaux anymore. But we are in a Mediterranean climate, much more so than Bordeaux. Bordeaux would be equal to almost Vancouver or Seattle. Well, we're equal to Italy. If you take the latitude, or if you go straight across on the globe. So we are warmer here. So terroir for Napa Valley is these ripe, supple tannins, dense, rich fruit that works with the soil to make these special wines. And I think if you say, I heard you say over, too much alcohol here or there, but I think that's what the grape properties can do, that you can make a ripe wine, but a balanced wine. And not every property can do that, but that's when you bring in the terroir, the grape properties can. So I think that's why we were looking for Howell Mountain, which allows us to, hang the fruit a long time to manage those tannins. Because Howell Mountain can be a very savage place to make red wines. But we feel our site, which is bathed in sunlight, it's exposed to the south, so the sun rotates over it, that we can hang the fruit up there a long time, not get high sugars, and make wines that are very much in balance, but very polished. That was our goal. That's why we think this property is perfect for that.
Uh-huh. Wow, Anthony, you're a guy who knows what he's doing. And can talk about it, too.
Now, quickly, Howell Mountain is in fact, a rather well-known appellation, but remind me of some of the other makers that are on Howell Mountain.
The leader of it all up here, there was two, is Randy Dunn. Randy Dunn is sort of the godfather up here and very, very positive with us working to build this winery. We've been he's been a great sort of a mentor for Plump Jack and now Cade, just to help us get everything through and the way to do things up here, because it is a small community up here, and you want to make sure that you're a partner with the community and do things the right way. So Randy Dunn, and then there's a gentleman by the name of Bill Smith who founded La Jota up here, sort of the grandfather and the godfather up here. But Duckhorn has a huge piece of property up here. Outpost Winery is a new up-and-coming winery. O'Shaughnessy Winery. David Avery, the famed vineyard manager, just bought a piece of property up here. Kendall Jackson owns property up here. But the problem is up here that there's very small pieces of property. On the valley floor, of course, it's expansive. And the funny thing is we think of big properties as 50, 60 acres here. But in Bordeaux, if you were to look at like Latour or Mouton Rothschild or any of these Grand Chateaus, you're looking at 200-acre swath a piece of property. So
okay. We're
actually quite small if you were to compare us to Bordeaux.
Now, characterize the wines that you make. We tasted them, but I must confess it was long enough ago that our wine memory is not as good as yours.
Well, our goal is to really make a balanced wine, a polished wine. We like rich, supple, rich density in the mid palates, lots of, nice black fruits and chocolates up front. But, again, we're trying to manage the tannins at Plump Jack. Plump Jack kind of does that for us. We have a wonderful piece of property there at Plump Jack. That 40 acres is, as we like to say, the tenderloin of Oakville. It's a beautiful swath of property. But now, Cade is completely different. And our goal is to polish the tannins, but not, again, back to this terroir word again, losing the what makes Howell Mountain so special in those wines. And it's a different flavor profile. It's a different tannin profile. But, again, it's all about the polishing of the tannins and rounding of the wine. And, again, we built this beautiful winery up here to do that. And what we do up on Howell Mountain to make these wines is different than what we do in Oakville. So.
And here's this whole thing we skimmed over. Is it, like, why is it certified?
Well, and then let's get back.
It says, I have this whole bulleted thing saying, the building features materials composed of concrete with 30% fly ash steel made up of it. And then also your natural ventilation. I don't get this. Blue jeans for insulation.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you mean?
Let's get a little bit into that. The first and foremost is that when we looked at this, we live here. And to be a good neighbor, we feel this way, and we feel it's the way to go. It's the future. The buildings are the future. LEED certification, which is let me get this right. It's leadership in energy and environmental design is the exact definition.
Okay, well done.
And we live here. You know, our general manager lives in St. Helena, and his daughter lives here. My daughter lives here. We know, and you want to be good to the land. You want to leave the land in a better situation than what you came to it. And by building with this LEED certification process, I think it allows us to do that. You know, the winery runs on a complete solar power year-round except for harvest because we are using a lot of power during harvest. Let's talk about the fly ash. It's 30% recycled fly ashes from coal-fired power plants. So they put that in the concrete. Again, that would go into landfill.
Well, what about these blue jeans? I'm really intrigued by this.
Let me do the rebar first. But the rebar is 90% recycled rebar. And then our insulation is blue jeans, ground-up blue jeans from...
I see.
Yeah.
Can you picture what I was picturing in my head about blue jeans hanging up?
No wallpaper. Blue jeans. It's ground up and put in between the walls.
Oh, that's funny. Now, I'm glad you explained that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we only have two heated conditioned spaces in the winery, and those are the ones that are insulated with blue jeans. Everything else is open air. We don't heat the winery or cool the winery. The roof is pitched, so when the room gets warm, the heat rises, we have louvers that open up and kick all the hot air out. So it's, and then we also have a bunch of this sort of, if you look at the, on the website at cadewinery.com, you can see that the smoked glass allows a lot of natural light through.
Uh-huh.
And basically, we turn the lights off during the day, and we work basically with just natural light.
Yeah. And then for visitors, you have plug-in bases for hybrid electric cars.
Exactly.
Bicycle racks.
Oh, yeah. You know, we do have bicycle racks.
And a shower.
We have a shower for people to take a shower. You know, you're going up from about 500 feet to 2,000 feet elevation. You'll get a good workout in, too, when you come up here on a bike. But, yeah, so all those things make sense to us. And then, of course, in the vineyard here, we're entering our first year of organic farming. It takes 3 years to be certified organic. But, again, the other things we believe in. And we've been farming sustainable, and now we're just going to go into organic. So we believe in all this. And we're not going to sit here and preach to anybody else, but we believe it's the right way to go. And we think in the future more and more companies, when they build a building, and more vineyards are going to be doing these things because it's the right thing.
Well, talk to us about the food component with this particular vineyard, Cade, but also with your others.
Well, you know, Cade Winery, you know, the nice thing about the difference between Cade Winery and Plumpjack Winery is Plumpjack is open for tasting 10 to 4 every day. We have a tasting permit done. You can just come in and say hello to us. It's almost like a party-like atmosphere at Plumpjack. Everybody has a great time pouring the wines. Cade's different in the fact that we'll have tours all day long by appointment, but twice a day we'll do food and wine pairing. We have a chef on staff, and he's going to be doing some wonderful appetizers while we taste the wines of Cade. So,
now that's something new.
You know, and Plumpjack in general has a lot of other restaurants. We are a food and wine, as well as a food company. We have some restaurants in San Francisco, as well as the farm down in Carneros at the Carneros.
Which attest is wonderful because we've been.
It's beautiful. I love it down there. It just has such a good feel of almost, you know, of Carneros as well as Napa Valley. So
talk to us about the wines themselves. You're producing three different, if you like, grades, three different
cabernets. And we don't use, I don't like grades.
Well,
they're all different.
I was searching for a word.
Yeah, I
understand.
Anthony,
and you come up with a good one.
That's just different wines in general because the first wine, we make a Sauvignon Blanc. I love Sauvignon Blanc. It's, to me, of course, the white wine of Bordeaux. And I love New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. We can make neither here in Napa Valley. We make Napa Valley Sauvignon Blanc. So we like to take some aspects of the New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc and blend it with some of the white Bordeaux aspects, like using Semillon, which they don't do in New Zealand, to craft this really rich, lush Sauvignon Blanc, but with some great sort of like cut grass aspects to it.
That would be very similar to an Australian Sauvignon Blanc Semillon combination.
Exactly.
Probably.
You know, Australia uses a ton of Semillon. You know, the Semi-Char they used to make down in Australia. But Semillon has such a nice roundness to Sauvignon Blanc. Sauvignon Blanc, of course, it can be very green and very lean. And the Semillon really fattens it out and actually gives some ageability to the Sauvignon Blanc. So that's why we do that there. And I think it makes a wonderful, rich, dense wine. And then to the red wines, we have three Cabernets. The Cade Cuvée, which is in the market right now. And then we'll be releasing our first Howell Mountain wine this fall. It gets to be called Cade Howell Mountain. And then in 2010, the first wine from the property here at Cade will be released. It'll be the Cade Estate in a special bottle. And the three different wines, the Cade Cuvée is from fruit on Howell Mountain, the estate, as well as some purchased fruit. Like we buy fruit from Andy Beckstoffer, Dr. Crane Vineyard, Tokalon Vineyard, as well as Kennefic Ranch and some other growers. And this is the most enjoyable wine to make for us, just for the simple fact that it allows us to blend. This wine will have all five Bordeaux varietals in it: Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot. We can go over the, you know, Malbec as well. And that, I think all the guys here on my staff love to play with this wine because you're able to blend the wines, and, you know, blending is the most enjoyable thing. Plump Jack and both Cade Estate, you're sort of limited to within the property you make the wines from. And how I'm out, I'm limited to the appellation. But with Cade Cuvée, which I think makes it so much fun, is we're able to buy grapes from anywhere within the Napa Valley and craft a wonderful wine. And that's what's so exciting about it. So,
well, it sounds like great fun. Now, you must have a website, so let's make sure we record that into the...
Sure, I think it's cadewinery.com.
Cadewinery.com. Well, Anthony Biaggi, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the menu. It sounds like at the beginning of a great adventure. This is a wine that people are going to want to look out for. They can already get the Sauvignon Blanc and
and it's in your market right now, absolutely. So there's a couple restaurants and retailers in your market that have it. I think Alfano's and Valmont's.
Well, remember we're heard around the world.
Oh, that's right. Well, I'm just thinking of Pittsburgh. I apologize.
no problem.
Well, you guys can go get them at least.
We can. So. It was such a pleasure to talk to you, Anthony. And as I say, we'll look forward to meeting you in person. And listeners, wine lovers, these are wines to watch out for, to get a taste of just as soon as you can, and to put on your list to buy when they come to market in the two new versions that are coming out.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Anthony.
Have a nice day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. It's not every day that On the Menu gets to meet the descendant of a real 49er, an 1849er who came seeking his fortune from France to California in 1849 during the gold rush. And turned out that 6 years later, his sixth-generation son, grandson, David, is making gold of a different kind, and his family's been doing that for six centuries. David Miroso, first of all, welcome to On the Menu, and welcome to our home city of Pittsburgh.
Well, Peter, thank you for such a warm welcome. I'm so excited to tell you some stories about the family.
Well, it's intriguing because lots of Italians move from Italy to California to make wine. Not so many people from France.
That's right. You know, in the 1800s, my great-great-great-grandfather, he fell in love with Henriette, and he told her that he wanted to go make his fortune in the California gold rush and that he would send for her when he made his fortune. Turns out he found a different type of gold, and that was the soil. He found out that the soil was the most fertile soil he had ever seen in the world. So he sailed back to France and loaded suitcase trunks and put those cuttings into the suitcase trunks and began to sail back with Henriette.
And he and Henrietta bought land, but it wasn't quite in the area where the gold fields were.
That's right. In the 1800s, there was actually shortages of food. And so they were the first people to bring the French prune from France to America. And so they actually did really well first planting prunes and apricots.
Shall we call them plums?
Yeah, plums.
Plums that were made into prunes.
That's right. And you know, the gold miners could use the prunes, you know, put them in their satchels, and it would continue to give them a great nutritious value. But the other thing that he brought to America, and he was the first to bring to America, was the cuttings of black Burgundy. And
when you say black Burgundy, that's Cabernet Sauvignon?
No, it's Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So we're the originators of Pinot Noir in California, and we believe in America as well.
So your descendant actually brought the Pinot Noir cuttings.
Yeah.
Even though where he was from is near Bordeaux.
Well, you know, the port of La Rochelle is where they left, but they grew up out there in Burgundy. So they had Burgundy always on their mind.
Okay, well, we have the enviable task, listeners, this afternoon. We have an array of seven wines in front of us, ranging from a Riesling, where I started out, probably to the top end in terms of potency, probably would be the Cabernet Sauvignon. So we have seven wines altogether. So
yes.
I thought, instead of simply just saying, well, this is a Sauvignon Blanc, and this is a Pinot Grigio, and this is a Pinot Noir, I would give David the task of saying, well, okay, I have seven wines from which to choose. So last night in the Hague household, we had trout.
Yes.
Tonight we're having salmon. tomorrow we're having steak. So guide me through the thought process, David, that would cause you to recommend one of your wines versus another.
I really like how you chose the dishes because, first of all, I'm an avid fisherman and I love to go out and spend time outdoors. I love a wonderful trout, beautifully cooked trout with lemon herb butter, maybe some toasted almonds on top. And what I would pair with that would be our Chardonnay. Because the Chardonnay has a wonderful kind of green apple and pineapple characters and a little hint of toast, but not too much. And so those toasted almonds would come out in the fish. And I just love Chardonnay and trout. It's a great pairing for me.
Now, is your Chardonnay characteristic of a Chardonnay from south of San Francisco rather than from the north?
Yeah. Our vineyards, the majority of our grapes are down in Monterey County, which is one of the longest growing seasons in the state of California. And so we get a little more hang time, and so we get more of those tropical flavors. And my idea on winemaking is not to overpower the wines, really let that fruit shine through.
Now, if I was having another kind of fish, though, I have two other choices, a Sauvignon Blanc and a Riesling. Oh, and a Pinot Grigio, too. So I'm spoiled for choice.
Are you asking me for the salmon choice?
Let's go on to salmon next.
Because salmon, I just love salmon. And it's probably because I love to pair it with one of my favorite types of wines. Salmon has an oily texture to it. And what I love about salmon is that you can actually pair it with Pinot Noir. It makes a perfect pairing. And what I like to do is I like to spice up the salmon a little bit. Also, the way you cook salmon can depend on what you might pair it with. And I usually grill it outside on the grill, even in the winter months in California. And it brings out these wonderful strawberry and cherry characters and a very silky finish on the Pinot.
Now, you probably have something that I want, but it wouldn't be a prudent investment in Pennsylvania, an outdoor kitchen.
Yeah, I do have an outdoor kitchen.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
Yeah, and it gets use, almost all year round.
Right, whereas I have to retreat from the snowfall and the cold weather for several months of the year. But we agree with you. So we're going to have Pinot Noir with our salmon tonight. But a lot of people would say it's a crossover fish.
Yeah.
So you could, in fact, pair it with a white. If you did that, what would be your choice of white?
Well, I would definitely pair that with our Pinot Grigio. Pinot Grigio has a little bit of a hint of sweetness to it, and that helps give more body weight to the wine. So it'll pair with a heavier fish like salmon. Also, the way you cook the salmon, if you grill it, let's say, it'll be a heavier weight and it'll pair with a heavier wine. So maybe you might broil it tonight or do something, in the oven, and that'll make it a little bit lighter and it'll pair better with a lighter type wine.
Okay. Now steak tomorrow. Steak tomorrow is probably more straightforward.
Yeah. Steak, I love to have a big red wine, of course. And my favorite is probably to have a Cabernet with steak. Now, there's one important thing about Cabernet and steak. Now, if you have a medium rare steak, the medium rare part of the meat or the rare part of the meat will help temper the tannins in Cabernet Sauvignon. And a lot of people don't know that. They just drink Cabernet with red meat. But if you medium rare on the steak, it'll help soften a heavier wine. And so that's why people pair cab with steak.
Now, the movie Sideways almost killed the business in Merlot, but that's a grape you also grow. What would you pair with Merlot?
You know what I like about our Merlot is the texture on the palate. The Merlot has a kind of velvety texture to it. And so what I really love to pair with it is like a pot roast, a country pot roast with roasted vegetables in there, and they're root vegetables, so they have a little bit of an earthy note to them, and they'll pair perfect.
So if I was doing my famous lamb shanks with Guinness and vegetables?
Oh, yeah. Lamb shanks and Merlot, I think, are a perfect pairing as well.
Well, that's another way of looking at the wine personality business, and it's one of the things that was brought to our attention, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to meet David, because you could also take a psychological approach.
That's right.
To deciding what wine personality you have, and therefore what wines you might favor. So instead of going for food, you would say, I'm a certain kind of person, so I'll always drink Merlot, because that's the personality that I have. So on the website, which is www.mirasu.com, and better spell it.
MIRASSOU.com.
So with seven different wines and several different characteristics. Let's take a look at one of these. Let's find out if you're a Merlot kind of person.
Well, Peter, let me explain to you why we came out with this.
Go ahead.
It's unscientific little quiz.
I never would have guessed.
But what I did was I worked with our team back at the winery, and I said, so many people have a tough time picking out wines. And so let's bring it down a level. Let's not make it complicated about, you know, if we're cooking in the house or on the grill. Let's pick a wine. We're going to someone's house. Well, what's that person like? Is she a sweetheart? You know, let's get her a Riesling. But the cool part of it is that you picked out this Riesling because it's for a sweetheart. Well, when you give the wine, you don't just say, here's a Riesling. You say, here's a Riesling because you're the sweetest person I know. And this is just a luscious wine, and it's sweet. And so it's a way to get the conversation open to enjoying wine.
Well, we're not going to give away any more of the answers, are we?
Oh, because, no.
Because there are seven different wines. There are 14 questions.
Yeah.
You can take the test for yourself and find out about yourself, or find out how, as David's suggesting, you might treat your friends.
Yes. Yes.
And David, it's been so much fun to have you with us on the menu. This is a fascinating family story. Now, do you go back to home in France?
Yeah, there's actually still a Mirasu home back in France, and we always bring back logo, golf shirts, and all kinds of fun things, and they love to have us come visit. In fact, there's a David Mirasu, and I didn't know there was one. But he lives in France, and next time I go, I'm going to look him up.
And they're still in the same area near La Rochelle?
Yeah, they're pretty close to La Rochelle, near the town of Pau. So
anyway, it's a wonderful part of California. If you're a golf fan, you're not very far from the Pebble Beach. If you're a scenery fan, you're not far from the 17-mile scenic drive.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, David, there's a warm welcome for people who visit the winery?
We don't actually have a welcome center.
Oh, we don't.
But we're working to do that down in Monterey County. But one of the great things that we do have is an amazing website. And if you come out to our website and take a look at that, we have wonderful contests called I Do with Mirasu, and people can go and win dream wedding for two, and just all kinds of fun things at our website.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here at On the Menu. You are with a number of restaurant wine people today, so I'm anticipating local listeners that you might find a little more Mirasu making its way onto region's wine lists, which will be a whole lot of fun. I'm sure that's one of the reasons that David came. He's off back to California this evening. So we're so glad we had a chance to talk to him. David, thank you so much for joining us on the menu. Do you have a parting thought?
Well, Peter, you know, we were talking about a lot of food and wine pairings, but my favorite way to pair wines is with great family and friends. So let's lift our glass to our great family and friends and toast to them and say good evening.
We will. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
And now let's take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and we're
going to
say... We
usually say, welcome back. We're doing something different.
Yeah, I could say something different. And we're going to be meandering through the backways and byways of Sonoma with a woman who knows them well, And she's such a wonderful name, Tilar. I love that name.
Yeah, and Tilar was in Texas. Tilar was in Texas with a sore throat, but she did a great interview
did great, yeah.
And she did a fine piece of work in putting together a book all about the kinds of places in Sonoma County that are off the beaten track that if you didn't have this book, you might never find.
Tilar Matseo. What a wonderful, wonderful name. You say the Tilar part is Finnish and the Matseo is Sicilian. What a combination, Tilar.
Thanks.
And did that happen when the Finns were conquering Sicily?
Exactly. I think the Finns are conquered by everybody.
The Normans were there, but I didn't think the Finns were there.
Well, my family are all blonde-haired, blue-eyed Italians as well.
So. Yeah, well, so my father was blonde-haired, blue-eyed. Yeah. I mean, I have a little help from the beauty shop now with the color, but basically I was dark.
Yeah.
So, but...
We're letting out all kinds of secrets on the air today.
I don't care.
Picture that.
I'd really love to be able to say I had a facelift, but unfortunately, I have not.
Picture that, listeners. Anne colors her hair. Peter doesn't. Guess who has the funniest looking hair? if you've been on our website, you've seen our picture. So we're recognized wherever we go.
Well, now you have very sterling credentials here. You are author of The Widow Clicquot, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm dying to read that. Is it juicy?
It is juicy. She was quite a lady.
Yep. And president of the International Society for Travel Writing, and you divide your time between Sonoma and Maine, which is, that's a split there,
yes,
weather-wise, and culture-wise, actually.
Yeah.
And you teach English at Colby, right?
That's correct.
Anyhow, but the book we're going to be talking about today is Back Lane Wineries of Sonoma. And we love it because we're just almost ready to take off for there. And it's just so packed with information. As Peter asked you before, tell us how to use this book. First of all, may I mention that it's one of those little bookstore, what do they call little bookshop books?
Little book room
books, which
yeah,
I adore.
Yeah, they make adorable guidebooks, don't they?
Oh, aren't they cute? Yeah. So we're easily going to pack this one. So anyhow, tell us how you went about writing this and how people are supposed to use it.
Right, yeah. I wrote it at the time I was living in Sonoma, and I still live there part of the year, but I was living there full-time at the time that I wrote this. And really, it was the guidebook that when I first moved to Sonoma County, I wished had existed. Because I had lived in Sonoma, I confess, about 6 months before I dared to pick up the phone when I saw one of those hand-painted signs on a back lane that said winery. Uh-huh. And by appointment only. And so what it is it's a travel guidebook to the really small, family-run boutique wineries of Sonoma.
And there are about how many altogether in the book?
There are about 70 in the book.
And what makes one qualify as a back lane winery?
Yeah.
I noticed Segesio, which is, I think that's how it's pronounced,
yep.
Which makes Segesio Family Estate Wines, is no small winery, I don't think,
right.
And their product is very excellent and very well known, and they're in there.
Yeah.
But if you go to the Alexander Valley section, then the Jordan Winery, which is of course one of the really long-standing and big ones, isn't in there. So what's the distinction?
Yeah, Segesio has actually dropped their production, and that's the reason they're in there. They decided to go back to being a much smaller production winery in the last 5 years or so. So the criteria is that it is wineries that are family-owned. So I worked really hard to, and hopefully I was successful, to make sure that it really wasn't owned by a corporate investment group, that it was a winery owned by a family who were really living in Sonoma County and involved in the community, and often, in the case of many of the old Italian families in particular, had very, very deep roots in the community. So genuinely family-owned and not primarily an investment group. And the other requirement was that everybody in the book is under 35,000 cases a year.
Okay.
If I had deleted just a couple of people, most everybody would have been under 12 or so. So the vast majority of the wineries in the book are easily under 12,000 cases a year, which in a county where the big commercial wineries are producing a million bottles of wine a year is still very much boutique. So those tend to be the kind of places that don't have large national distributions, that really tend to distribute simply from the tasting room into local restaurant sales.
Now, they're all places that someone can call and visit?
Yes, they're all, and exactly, yes, a good point. They're all also places that are open to the public. Now, the smallest wineries in that book make maybe 150, 200 cases a year. So some of them are extremely small, and that when you call and make an appointment with somebody, you're meeting somebody in the back of a pickup truck on a vineyard estate.
Right. I've visited wineries like that in Oregon in particular, where the person who greets you when he comes out of the shed is actually the owner.
Exactly. And, I mean, that really is, in most cases, which I think is part of the charm of it being family-run. I mean, the reason that these are by appointment only in many cases, although not in all cases, maybe not quite half of the places have tasting rooms that are staffed during the week, but more than half of the places are appointment only. And that's the reason. It's the person who's greeting you at the door is the person who otherwise would be out, working in the vineyard, taking cases of wine around to local restaurants. So it's by appointment only because somebody wants to make sure they're there to greet you and they aren't staffing a tasting room during the week.
Now, you've also got some other resources in there. So you've got restaurants and places you can buy provisions and that kind of thing as well.
Right. And what I tried to do there was, I mean, obviously I included some of the really wonderful, famous places. Just because somebody's famous, it doesn't mean they don't make great food. So I did include a couple of the places
that your listeners will know about.
But I tried really hard to make sure that I included the places that where the locals, the local foodies all go.
And Cyrus, the local drinking salt. They all could show
right, Cyrus is one of the ones everybody knows, and it's fabulous. I mean,
it is great. We've been there.
Yeah, but Dirk's Parkside or Chloe's Cafe, those are all small places that are, you go there and what you see are locals who know their food and know it well, and you very, very rarely see tourists there.
We're going to keep the secret just a little bit here so that people are inclined to buy the book. But since we're going to Sonoma, could we ask you separately to send us an email containing three or four of your very favorite places?
Absolutely.
And if we keep that a secret until we've been there.
there's a Sicilian way what I'll have to do to you if you reveal my secret.
They won't be overcrowded when we get there. They won't be overcrowded after we leave.
Exactly.
Because we'll certainly put them on the air, and then the secret will definitely
be out. I'd
be
happy to give you some favorites. There's some great places. And those are two of them. I mean, Dirk's Parkside and Chloe's are both very small places that are fabulous. Rosa. I mean, a lot of the places I've been in the book were places like that. And there are also places I chose that had really excellent local wine lists and places that had inexpensive corkage, so that if you wanted to bring a bottle of wine, you'd found when you were out tasting that you weren't planning to take home, you'd have a lovely setting to open it in.
I love when you're at these places, vintners come in with bottles of their wine to give to the owner of the restaurant, and then they start sharing around at the tables with the other guests. I mean, it was just really fun.
Yep, exactly. I was in a restaurant just 2 weeks ago, and I was in Napa, and exactly that happened. Had a chance to taste one of those wines I never thought. It was a 53 Cheval Blanc that somebody had opened.
Oh, my God.
I was, as you can imagine.
Now, what is your primary, I don't know what to say, not occupation, focus? Let's just do focus. I mean, is it wine?
Really, the way I make my living as a writer is actually on luxury goods in general, especially French luxury goods.
French luxury goods.
Yeah, it's the Widow Clicquot. Right now I'm writing a book on the history of Chanel No. 5. So wine is one of those luxury goods that I write a lot about, food and wine also. So history of food and wine, but also history increasingly these days of perfume.
Well, how did you get there? I mean, like, you grew up in Sonoma?
Nope, I didn't grow up in Sonoma. I moved to Sonoma when my now ex-husband had taken a job out there. That's why we ended up moving there originally. And I grew up in Maine, so teaching in Maine is a funny return home for me. I grew up in Camden.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, which is a beautiful little town if anyone's ever visited the tourist places on the East Coast. So I grew up in Camden and then moved away from New England. We moved to the West Coast when I was in my early 20s to go to graduate school. And the reason I got into wine was that my first job, I went to graduate school at University of Washington, and when I was there, I got very lucky and was friends with a gentleman who bought wine for the local grocery store.
Oh, really?
And he gave me an education in wine that had me drinking my way through graduate school bottles of wine that no graduate student should have been able to afford. This graduate student couldn't afford, in fact.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, and there were great wineries, obviously, coming out of Washington in the early 90s. And then my first job after graduate school was at Oregon State University. And
anyone's
ever been there knows there's not much to do besides drink Pinot Noir.
I think Peter worked there for a while.
Yeah.
Where is that? What city is it in?
That's in Corvallis.
What part of the state is that?
You know, it's the center. It's about an hour and a half south of Portland, and it's right in the heart of, well, it's just south of Pinot Noir.
Well, really, the heart of it. We love Oregon wines.
Yeah. Oh, they make great wines. And so I really loved Pinot Noir, especially the kind they were making in Oregon. And then when I got a job, I moved to Wisconsin and got a job at one of the university branch campuses at the University of Wisconsin. And there was not any local wine to indulge myself in.
No.
So I became a great fan of French champagne, and that was how I ended up writing the book about the Widow Clicquot, who founded a champagne house. And that was really, you know, sort of how that particular focus in my writing began, is I wrote a biography of her and went to France, worked with the archive. One thing led to another.
Now, when you're writing about the Chanel, are you writing about cocoa, or are you writing about the perfume?
I'm really writing about the perfume. One of the things I'm interested in is, what's the connection between essentially wine and perfume? I mean, really, the interest in perfume comes out of my interest in wine. If you think mm-hmm. about it, essentially, it's volatiles in alcohol.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Alcohol you don't drink, so...
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite books, I think they made it into a movie, was Perfume.
Yeah, that was a great mystery novel, wasn't it?
Wasn't it wonderful?
Yeah.
Well,
Poor old Tilar has a croaky voice. And
yeah, she doesn't sound like this usually.
And no, normally I don't sound quite so.
And you have a speech to give in Texas right now, so we hope it goes well, and thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Yeah, keep in touch, Tilar.
Would love to do that.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye now.
I'm ready to leave already. I'm so sorry that we're not going tomorrow, but we'll be reporting back on all the adventures that we have in California in late May and early June when we get back. And in the meantime, we wish you a happy week until next week, where we'll see you same time, same place.
Bye-bye.